www.ecom.org/en. In Britain, delays to the vaccination rollout mean some 12 to 15-year-olds may not get their COVID jab until February of next year, 15 weeks after the government's original target for offering the jab to all eligible teenagers, according to the Labour Party. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Sally Wheel and Dennis Campbell. The piece is titled, COVID jab wait for 12 to 15-year-olds in England could be up to 5 months. In Britain, delays to the vaccination rollout mean that some 12 to 15-year-olds may not get their COVID jab until February of next year, 15 weeks after the government's original target for offering the jab to all eligible teenagers, according to the Labour Party. Officials originally set October half-term as a target to invite those in the age group to receive the vaccine in schools, after criticism that England was slow to approve it for children compared to other countries. New analysis by Labour Party suggests, however, that if the vaccination of the 2.8 million eligible 12 to 15-year-olds continues at the current rate, it could take until 7th of February next year for some teenagers to be jabbed, a five-month wait for some. Vaccination began in schools in September, but with high infection numbers and low vaccination rates, a growing number of walk-in vaccine sites have since been made available to speed up the process. According to the new analysis, over a four-week period, up to 15th of November, an average of just over 147,000 school pupils got the jab each week. Latest reported figures show that almost 60% of children are still unvaccinated, while 42.1%, almost 1,127,000 of them, have been vaccinated. Labour has called on the government to make better use of community pharmacies and pop-up clinics, as well as bring back volunteers and retired clinicians to expand capacity and speed up vaccinations of 12 to 15-year-olds. The Shadow Education Secretary, Kate Green, said, "Children have been treated as an afterthought throughout this pandemic and continue to be let down by a Conservative government which has shown no care for them and their futures." Paul Whiteman, General Secretary of the National Association of Head Teachers, said, "We don't know yet what the final take-up of the vaccine will be for teenagers. It may never be as high as in the general population. So it is important that other measures are also pursued to control COVID in schools, including help to improve key mitigation such as better ventilation in classrooms, reconsidering the current guidance on close contact isolation, and an effective track and trace system to ensure cases are identified early." The Department of Health and Social Care spokesperson said, Our vaccination program continues to be a phenomenal success, and children can get vaccinated at school or use the national booking system. Already, over 40% of 12 to 15-year-olds have been vaccinated. Vaccines save lives, and we're doing everything we can to keep encouraging more people to come forward. Our booster program has made huge progress, with over 15 million doses of the vaccine administered so far across the United Kingdom. Walk-in vaccine clinics for 12 to 15-year-old teenagers are expected to be launched in England within weeks to stem rising rates of COVID-19 infections within secondary schools. The news came as the United Kingdom recorded 45,140 new COVID cases, the highest daily number since middle of July, and 57 new deaths within 28 days of a positive test. The percentage of Britons testing positive for coronavirus is currently highest for those aged between 12 and 15. Yet the vaccination rate among this age group stands at just 14.2% in England, compared to 44.3% in Scotland, prompting criticism about England's decision to administer vaccinations solely through schools. Older teenagers in England can already attend walk-in clinics to receive their first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, with 56.5% of 16 to 18-year-olds now vaccinated. The expansion of the scheme to younger teenagers would bring England into line with Scotland, where 12 to 15-year-old teenagers can also attend walk-in clinics. In Wales, 12 to 15-year-olds are largely being vaccinated at vaccination centres, while in Northern Ireland, like England, the rollout is largely being conducted within schools. Ministers are also planning to expand walk-in vaccination appointments to younger teenagers amid concern that the government has been too slow rolling out the vaccine program in English schools.
We get people.
Brutal brutes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll speak about police brutality, which has become synonymous with police action in the U.S. Every single year, more than 1,000 Americans die at the hands of police, and the numbers only seem to be rising. This week, we have two distinguished guests on our program, Gerald Horn, who is a professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston, and Life Malcolm, who is a community organizer. Please stay with us.
Statistics show that the trend of fatal police shootings in the U.S. seems to only be increasing, with a total of 716 civilians having been shot, 111 of whom were black, as of October 2021. In 2020, there were 1,021 fatal police shootings, and in 2019, there were 999. Additionally, the rate of fatal police shootings among black Americans was much higher than that for any other ethnicity, standing at 37 fatal shootings per million of the population as of October 2021.
And now, based on research published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America, police violence is a leading cause of death for young men in the U.S. over a life course, about one in every 1,000 black men can expect to be killed by police. Professor Horn explains the state of police brutality in America a year after the murder of George Floyd.
You may recall that after the killing of George Floyd at the hands of the Minneapolis Police Department in the late spring of 2020, there were massive demonstrations, not only in the United States, but around the world, because of the police terror inflicted upon black people. By some measures, these represented the largest demonstrations in the history of the United States of America. And as a result, we expected serious change to ensue. But that change has not come as of yet. In fact, there has been a backlash against change. You may have seen the results of the elections that took place in the United States on the first Tuesday of November of 2021. And you may also have noticed that many politicians were elected who are opposed to any change in police practices. This suggests that going forward, the road will be rocky indeed.
Black men are about 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than are white men. Black people who are fatally shot by police seem to be twice as likely as white people to be unarmed. Latino, American Indian, and Alaskan Native men and women are also significantly more likely to be killed by police than their white counterparts. Mr. Malcolm tells us if anything has improved more than a year after George Floyd's death.
No, nothing has improved regarding police brutality in the U.S. since George Floyd. It's likely worsened, if there is such a thing. It's always been extreme violence and extreme terror at the hands of police when it comes to African people and other colonized people in the U.S. The George Floyd murder happened to be one of the most brutal instances of police violence captured on video, maybe since the Rodney King beating in the early 1990s in this country. And so everybody had an opportunity to, you know, when I say everybody, I mean people all around the world had the opportunity to witness the extreme violence and police terror that police heap upon the heads of ordinary Africans in this country every day.
Information from more than 2 million 911 calls in two U.S. cities reveals that white officers dispatched to black neighborhoods fired their guns 5 times more than black officers dispatched for similar calls to the same neighborhood. So what is the role of race when it comes to police violence?
In the United States, overwhelmingly and disproportionately, the victims of police terror happen to be black. Many of us see this as the legacy of slavery. You know that in the United States and North America, there has been enslavement of African people longer than there has been freedom for African people. Enslavement of African people for 300 years or more, freedom, quote unquote, for a period since 1865.
In many states, a Bill of Rights for law enforcement officers shields personnel from investigation into misconduct. Even officers who are fired for misconduct are frequently rehired. The New York Times reported in 2015 that the police officer in Cleveland, Ohio, who fatally shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice in 2014, had previously resigned from another police department after it had deemed him unfit to serve. The Cleveland police did not review the officer's personnel file before hiring him.
Intelligent people who are colonized don't fight and struggle against racism. We all who are colonized in this world by white people, the role that racism plays in police brutality is to distract colonized people from the real struggle, which is that against colonialism, the fight for power, the fight for land, the fight for territory, the fight for freedom.
After many incidents in which police use brute force against unarmed African Americans, it seemed that people were fed up once they watched exactly how police officer Derek Chauvin planted a knee in the back of the neck of George Floyd for over 9.5 minutes and killed him, all the while he pleaded that he cannot breathe. The question one might ask is that are American police more violent in general?
I think that the figures show that the United States is one of the most violent nations on planet Earth. I see this as a legacy of how the nation was created. It was created by a violent seizure of the land from the indigenous population, a liquidation of a good deal of the indigenous population, and then kidnapping Africans with violence and bringing them to these shores to work for free for hundreds of years. That led to slave revolts that were repressed with bloodshed. And this is the culture that has been bequeathed to us today.
Thousands started protests and riots across America and later all around the world against police violence. The protesters demanded the defunding of the police, prosecution of the officers involved, and a dramatic change in law enforcement procedure, law, police recruitment, and to dismantle the systems of mass criminalization and incarceration. In light of these protests, what has the U.S. government done to decrease police violence?
The only thing that the American government, the United States government, has done for police brutality is give the brutal police more money, almost in every city and every state in this country. Each year, the police budget increases. The numbers, the headcount on the police force increases. And of course, the brutality of the police increase. So if the United States government has done anything and to that affects police brutality, it's give them more money for more guns and more terroristic tactics.
This is why, according to a report published in 2020, police budgets continue to be consistent across diverse geographies and cities in America, with up to 20 to 45% of discretionary funds allocated to the violent system.
After Reconstruction, the slave patrols morphed into local police departments, determined to enforce Jim Crow laws to control black people. Police unions really began consolidating power in the 1950s, in response to activists pushing for police reform. Fighting against oversight and advocating fiercely for their own ranks, they developed strict rules that remain in place for most police forces today. Police power continued to expand after the 1960s civil rights movement. The 1965 Law Enforcement Assistance Act, part of President Johnson's administration's war on crime, paved the way for militarization and funding by increasing federal involvement in local policing through grants. The support for local law enforcement from the federal government continued to grow, with a series of laws passed under subsequent presidents, from Reagan to Trump, that further aligned police departments with the military and perpetuated funding.
Center for Popular Democracy Action released newly updated data from their 2017 Freedom to Thrive report. The updated data exemplified much of what is already known to be true. The police continue to receive an astronomical percentage of discretionary funds compared to resources that actually keep communities safe. All of the police budgets analyzed in the report have increased since 2017.
Certainly under Mr. Trump, the police were out of control. The U.S. Justice Department, which has central authority over the so-called criminal justice system, basically went asleep under Mr. Trump between 2016 and his defeat in 2020.
Also, police reform movements largely failed on ballots across the nation, but one Black Lives Matter activist running on a defund the police platform won a seat and became the youngest member of the Des Moines, Iowa City Council.
The Black Lives Matter movement has given so-called officials an out, an escape. It allows these so-called officials to appear to be friends of African and other colonized people in the U.S. by adopting this pop slogan, you know. But the reality is, Joseph Robinette Biden, who is the same white man who put 100,000 or so police on the street that do the brutality to African people you and I are discussing right now, all the time. That same Joseph Robinette Biden, who is the puppet master of the police, can say Black Lives Matter. Some police will say Black Lives Matter, and at the same time shoot Black lives down.
In Minneapolis, where Floyd was killed by a police officer last year, voters rejected a citywide ballot measure, also known as Question 2, to overhaul the city's police department by replacing it with a new agency that would take a public health approach to law enforcement. Five council members who backed the initiative were ousted from their seat. And in Seattle, a city that saw extended protests in the wake of Floyd's death, Republican Ann Davison won over the former public defender and police and jail abolitionist Nicole Thomas Kennedy to become the new Seattle city attorney. So what can be done to stop the violence, discrimination, and abuse?
We have to be courageous enough to fight back. There's no other way. Malcolm X said it best. When the white man has his flag, we have our flag. When the white man has his army, we have our army. When the white man has his gun, we have our gun. And we just have to be intelligent, organize, create and build dual and contending power. And last, but certainly not least, most of all, make a revolution. And that means overturn this nasty, stinking, foul social system, colonial capitalism, and bring into existence a socialist world under the leadership of the African working class.
The recent city elections illustrate the racist views held by many in law enforcement runs deeper than the police departments and prisons. Racism is a disease that many citizens of the United States possess, and therefore do not vote for public officials who intend to reform police departments and decries the systematic racism and brutality in these areas. And now let's check in with Abbas Montarem to see what he has for us.
Peace and welcome back to Power to the People. On our last segment of Power to the People, we discussed how the United States is a settler colonial regime. Just to give you all a quick refresher, settler colonialism is when a non-native people, in the case of America, Europeans, came to the indigenous people's lands and set up political, economic, military, and social rule. They established a permanent population, and at the same time they was doing that, they displaced the indigenous people, right? Then at the same time they was doing that, they was enslaving us, African peoples, right? We must fundamentally understand that settler colonialism is genocidal. It is, point blank period, it is genocidal. On October 22nd, a group called the In Spirit of the Mandela Coalition found the United States guilty of genocide. As African peoples, as indigenous peoples, as brown people, we have understand through ancestral knowledge, through the knowledge passed down through our elders, through being students of the Black radical tradition, that our experience on this land called America is genocidal, right? And this tribunal successfully charged the United States guilty with genocide, right? So to begin to understanding genocide, we have to understand the United Nations definition of genocide, right? United Nations, in the present convention, genocide may be any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part amongst national lines, ethnic lines, racial lines, religious groups, right? And some of these components of genocide are one, killing members of a group, two, causing serious bodily harm or mental harm to members of the group, three, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring apart its physical destruction in whole or in part, four, imposing measures intended to prevent the births of a group, and five, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. International jurists throughout the world came to Harlem, right, came to the historic Audubon in which El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, also known as Malcolm X, was martyred, and picked up that torch in which Malcolm was calling for the international community to be aware of the human rights condition here in America, right? The jurists picked up the torch, right? The spirit of the Mandela Coalition picked up the torch and successfully charged genocide against the United States of America, right? They charged genocide amongst five specific charges. One, the racist police killings of black, brown, and indigenous people. Two, the hyper-incarceration of black, brown, and indigenous people. Three, the political incarceration of civil rights, national liberation era revolutionaries, as well as current day activists. Four, the environmental racism and the impact on black, brown, and indigenous communities, right? Five, public health racism. All of these charges together call for genocide. And that's what it is genocide. And the U.S. was found guilty of genocide, right? If we understand our history, we know that African people have been murdered on this land. Right, through the transatlantic slave trade, it's estimated between 70 to 100 million of our people were murdered, and through slavery were murdered, right? And it didn't end there. Through Jim Crow, there was lynchings, murders, right? We understand that the pigs, the police, right, kill us every day, right? The pigs kill us, the pigs incarcerate us, right? We have vigilantes like George Zimmerman murdering our children like Trayvon Martin. Right, Emmett Till was beat up, killed, murdered by white supremacists. This is what is genocide, right? The killing of our groups, the killing of the members of our groups, the killing of our new African nation, the killing of our black nation, right? That is genocidal, right? We know that new African youth have been forced into foster care through this racist system of foster care, right? Taking our children from our people, from our house, and taking them elsewhere, right? We know that this has happened and has continued to happen, right? We know that black, brown, and indigenous women have been forcibly sterilized by this racist government, right? And through that, it affects the population from growing, right? We know that today, more black men are under correctional control than were enslaved. We went from the slave plantation all the way to the prison plantation, right? These are genocidal acts that have been committed. And the jurists, right, after hearing hours and hours and hours of testimony over 2 days, found the U.S. guilty of genocide, right? So what does that mean now? Yes, this will be submitted to the United Nations. Yes, lawsuits will be filed, right? But we do not believe that the United Nations in itself will deploy troops because we know that the UN has oftentimes been a proxy for American violence. It has not done anything to sanction the United States on the violence that it has committed not only to black, brown, and indigenous people on this land, but to black, brown, indigenous people throughout the world, right? So it's important that we document this history. We document this genocide. We must say we will never forget the African Holocaust that has occurred, right? The African genocide that has and continues to occur on this land, right? And we must, as people who are struggling against imperialism, colonialism, we must call our position in this land as genocide. Because once we realize that is genocide, right, and once we understand that the U.S. is guilty of genocide, it puts the U.S. up there with the Adolf Hitlers of the world. And if we study Adolf Hitler, we know that Adolf Hitler learned about genocide from the United States of America, right? And it is our human right. We must understand that it is our human right to stop genocide against our people. The United Nations says that. The United Nations doesn't quote-unquote permit genocide, right? But genocide has been found, and now it is our human right to stop that genocide. So we must embody, as what Jalil Muntu Keem says, we are our own liberators. We are our own liberators, and we must stop the genocide against black, brown, and indigenous people. We must stop the genocide that the U.S. government commits every single day when it drops bombs in the Middle East, when it tries to steal the oil from Iran. That is genocidal. these sanctions is genocidal, right? So as people who are facing genocide, as Africans, as African people facing genocide, it is our human right to stop this genocide. It is our human right to organize, to fight back, and to stop this genocide. We must embody the slogan, "We are only brothers." Power to the people.
Well, that was our show, everyone. I am your host, Daniel Arya, and do join us again next week on another episode of We the People. Bye-bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The unity of Muslims is a definite Quranic duty. This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
As you can see, the puppets installed by the US create discord in the world of Islam wherever they can. The closest example is the tragic, upsetting events in Afghanistan these last two Fridays, where they blew up a Muslim mosque while the people were praying. Who blew it up? Daesh. Who are Daesh? Daesh is the same group about whom the Americans, the Democrats in the United States, clearly stated, "We created this." Of course, they don't say this now, they deny it. But they have done this and they have explicitly acknowledged it. Therefore, it is necessary for us to pursue this matter. We should not think that when we gather, hold discussions and talk during Unity Week every year, be that one or two meetings in different parts of the world, we shouldn't think when we sit together and talk that we have done our duty. No, our duty is not finished by just doing these things.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
It is necessary for everyone, in any place and wherever they are, to act as an axis for the important discussion of unity. We must discuss, explain, motivate, plan, and divide the work in these areas. This is a task that is obligatory and necessary, and it must be done. For example, in the case of Afghanistan, when I say that we need to formulate plans, One way to prevent these incidents is for the current honorable Afghan officials to go to the mosques themselves and to say their prayers there, or to encourage the Sunni brothers to go to these centers. When we say that we should plan, these are things that can be done in the world of Islam. The creation of a new Islamic civilization depends on the cooperation of all Muslims. The next point is that one of the goals of the Islamic Republic that we have defined is to create a new Islamic civilization. That is, one of the goals of the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution is to create a new Islamic civilization by taking into consideration today's capacities and today's facts and realities. This is only possible with the unity of the Shia and the Sunnis. This cannot be done by just one country or one sect. To do this, everyone must work together. This is the next point. So, this is another necessary matter.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The United States has always touted itself as a leading democracy in the world. In line with such a narrative, the US is scheduled to hold a so-called summit on democracy next month. But the names of some of the participants and absentees cast doubt on the motive behind such an event. The inclusion of Taiwan, and not China, poses not only a challenge to Washington, but exposes its real intention.
The U.S. action to push forward the group politics and provoke allied confrontations under the cover of democracy is a reproduction of the Cold War mentality, which is widely questioned and opposed by the wise persons in the international community.
Russia, which has also been excluded from the summit, said the meeting is aimed at creating divisions among countries and privatizing the term democracy.
They wish to privatize the very word democracy. In their opinion, democracy is only what corresponds to Washington's understanding of democracy. Obviously, this cannot be so and must not be so. And in fact, it is not.
Another challenge the U.S. faces is its decision to include Israel in the list of over 100 invitees to the virtual gathering. It has put a big question mark to the democratic nature of the event, given the Israeli regime's atrocities and crimes against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip on a daily basis. The administration of President Joe Biden claims the summit seeks to help stop democratic backsliding and erosion of rights and freedoms worldwide. Nonetheless, earlier this week, the Stockholm-based International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance said it is the first time that the U.S. has been added to its list titled Backsliding Democracies. The international think tank also pointed to a, quote, decline in the quality of freedom of association and assembly in the U.S. during the summer 2020 protests after the police killing of George Floyd. Floyd's death once again turned the spotlight on racial bias toward African Americans and other minority groups in the U.S. The support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen and huge arms sales to the kingdom also put a question mark on U.S. claims to be a leading human rights advocate. The U.S. military adventurism has also exposed its real face. Invasions of Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and some other countries under different pretexts, including fighting terrorism and bringing democracy, have only resulted in the loss of lives of hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians. Sanctions are yet another tool the United States has used for decades against others, including Iran and Venezuela. But the economic warfare has brought suffering to the people in these countries, as they are unable to access the basic humanitarian needs such as food and medicines, leading to the death of many innocent people. Given the humanitarian impacts of U.S. policies and its long-standing support for undemocratic regimes, it remains to be seen how Washington wants to protect democracy in the format of its planned summit.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors convenes a virtual meeting a day after IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi's trip to Tehran. Addressing the board, Grossi said the extensive negotiations with high-ranking Iranian officials to address outstanding issues had proven inconclusive, but that he would not give up on efforts to come to an understanding.
The talks were constructive. The talks were correct. The talks were professional. So that is one thing. But we could not reach an agreement.
Grossi said the sides must reach an agreement that would allow the agency to access surveillance equipment at Iran's Karaj workshop, warning the IAEA is close to the point where it would not be able to guarantee the continuity of knowledge. Iran says it's conducting a judicial and security investigation at the site following a terrorist attack blamed on Israel and cannot legally allow the agency access while the investigation is underway. Tehran has asked the IAEA to assist in the investigation as the attack destroyed one of the agency's cameras. In a separate report to the board, Grossi also mentioned questions that still need to be clarified about the presence of uranium particles at three locations not declared to the agency. Iran has previously responded by asking the IAEA not to magnify non-urgent issues related to the country's past activities, saying some of the questions are based on unsubstantiated claims and images provided by the country's enemies.
Iranian officials say despite differences of opinion with the agency, efforts will continue to bring the outstanding issues to a final resolution. Iran has also urged other IAEA member states to refrain from adopting any hasty or politically motivated position. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
It's envisaged EU leaders and the European Parliament will almost certainly rubber stamp new anti-immigrant proposals put forward by the European Commission on Tuesday. Any airline or ferry company deemed by the EU to be carrying illegal immigrants destined for the bloc will be placed on a blacklist. The Commission accuses Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko of bringing migrants to EU borders in retaliation for sanctions imposed on Minsk.
I think he has missed the game, because what he has got is a new round of sanctions, and now he will have to contribute and to take care of these people.
The European Commission is giving €200 million to EU countries Poland, Lithuania and Latvia for border controls. Poland is already accused of human rights abuses against migrants. Between 10 and 15,000 migrants are still in Belarus. The EU is spending a total of €3.5 million to facilitate their deportation.
We are now ready to accelerate with many more planes coming out of Belarus, and we will mobilize additional funds of around €1 million to support these returns.
It has never been harder for genuine refugees to reach the European Union. Under international law, they are entitled to seek asylum here. Most of them are in countries ravaged by Western war machines.
Vulnerable asylum seekers and refugees are getting caught in the middle and falling through the gaps. So we need the kind of political will that member states express when they come together and meet, but don't then follow through.
EU leaders will hold a summit here at the European Council in just under a month's time from now, and the refugee crisis will be high on the agenda. Rights groups are pleading with them to switch the focus from border protection to people protection. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An Iranian plane carrying another cargo of humanitarian aid landed at Nangarhar Airport in eastern Afghanistan on Sunday. This shipment of Iranian aid contains food and medicine and will be distributed to the vulnerable families, including victims of recent terrorist attacks. The Iranian officials said they will continue assisting their neighboring country.
We thank God that we could successfully hand over Islamic Republic of Iran's humanitarian aid supplies to our neighboring nation. These batches include 6 tons of rice and 4 tons of medicine. I hope it is not our last aid to eastern Nangarhar and other Irans follow it.
Afghanistan, embattled by 2 decades of war, has long been grappling with a humanitarian crisis. The situation worsened after the Taliban took over of the country, as the U.S. and international organizations cut off Afghanistan's access to assets and loans. Now, Taliban officials are calling for humanitarian aid.
Our demand from Iran and world countries is to send more humanitarian aid to Afghan vulnerable people. This airport had been controlled by invaders, but it will be open for all flights, including aid shipments.
We thank Iran or any country who helps us survive in this hunger and poverty. Prices are surging and cold winter is approaching. What can these people do for a living if the international community doesn't provide aid?
The previous 12 cargoes of Iranian aid to the Afghan people were sent to capital Kabul as well as several cities across the country, including Herat, Kandahar, and Kunduz by land and air over the past 3 months. Iran also stepped up its humanitarian efforts in Afghanistan after a series of Daesh-claimed terrorist attacks hit the war-ravaged nation.
The United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan warns that abandoning the Afghan people now would be a historic mistake, stressing urgent steps must be taken to address what the UN has called a looming humanitarian catastrophe. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A BBC journalist caused a social media storm over the weekend after a series of tweets angered the online Afghan community. During his latest visit to Afghanistan, the BBC's John Simpson shared a series of pictures of Afghan Muslim men alongside derogatory comments which onlookers considered offensive and Islamophobic.
So the tweet which has caused the most outrage online is this one right here, which appears to show an image of a Muslim Afghan, a native of that country, alongside text Mr. Simpson has added, saying that it's very sad that he's leaving the country now, even though it's run by people like this. And it's this type of terminology which has confused and frustrated many online. Other posts again tried to show the audience that Afghan men should be treated with suspicion, whilst at the same time I can't find a single mention of Britain's destructive role in the country throughout Mr. Simpson's Twitter feed.
Afghan Twitter users vented their frustration over the belittling wording.
Guessing you did not tell this young man you would be disparaging him online when you asked for his picture. Typical journalist.
John Simpson is extremely sad because finally foreign invaders, mostly whites, are no longer running Afghanistan. Typical white supremacist mentality.
I bet you never said something like this about British soldiers carrying weapons killing Afghans thousands of miles away from home.
I did see his tweet and I grimaced when I saw it. It was insensitive to say the least. And of course, the difficult thing is you can never get the intonation or the manner in which it's sent. But for a man of his vast experience, for somebody whose, you know, words are the tools of their trade, I thought it was incredibly insensitive and patronizing. And with the outrage that followed, I think it would have been quite wise to press the delete button.
Simpson hasn't apologized this time, but this isn't the first occasion his comments have caused a stir.
In 2001, he did admit wrongdoing after claiming he liberated Kabul following the city's fall to Western-backed forces, which began the occupation. Robert Carter, London.
Chief of the UN nuclear watchdog Rafael Grossi is in Iran on his third visit this year to address what he earlier called outstanding questions regarding Iran's nuclear program. On Monday, he held talks with head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mohammad Islami. The discussion took 2 hours behind closed doors before the two officials briefed reporters on the major points of the talks.
Our work has been intense in the course of the morning, and we are continuing at this point our negotiations with a view to finding common ground and also to continue and to deepen the dialogue with the government of Iran.
Grossi also visited Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian later in the day to ask the Iranian government to enhance its cooperation with the IAEA. Grossi last visited Tehran in September when he obtained Iran's approval for international access to monitoring cameras installed at Iranian nuclear sites, while the Islamic Republic later curtailed the IAEA's inspection of its nuclear facilities. Following a series of what Tehran called politically motivated comments made by the atomic watchdog against Iran, the Iranian nuclear chief said Tehran is determined to resume its technical cooperation with the agency on the condition that the IAEA stay away from the political atmosphere and stick to its technical task.
We agreed today that our ties with the IAEA must remain at technical levels, and the atomic agency will not be affected by conspiracies hatched by our enemies to disrupt our nuclear program.
Grossi's visit comes ahead of the Vienna nuclear talks between Iran and world powers. The dialogues have been stalled for more than 5 months under the new Iranian administration. The nuclear accord promised sanctions relief for Iran in exchange for the country curtailing its nuclear program. But in 2018, the United States withdrew from the deal and reinstated sanctions against Tehran under then-President Donald Trump. In response, Tehran has since stepped up activity in its nuclear program, including increasing its stockpile and grade of enriched uranium above the limits set by the deal. Now, Tehran and Washington will engage in indirect talks for the seventh round in Vienna on November 29th to seek ways for the U.S. to rejoin the deal and return for Iran to come back to full obligation.
Iran assured the IAEA that it will return to full compliance to the JCPOA, but it says that requires a political will from the U.S. and Europe to lift the anti-Iran sanctions, an issue which seems to be the gist of next week's discussions in Vienna. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Under the slogan the U.S. supports the military and economic escalation and the continuation of aggression and siege, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and other cities to demonstrate against the U.S. for its support for the ongoing Saudi war on their country.
The U.S.'s backing rule has been confirmed by the country's officials' statements. We are involved in a comprehensive battle to defend our homeland. The recent escalation is the result of the repeated defeats that the Saudi-led coalition has been suffering, especially in Marib province.
Protesters chanted slogans blaming the U.S. for the humanitarian crisis in the country, saying that the U.S. will remain the main supporter of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, no matter who takes power in Washington.
The U.S. is providing Saudi Arabia with logistic and political support. The blockade on Yemen has been imposed based on the U.S. order. The U.S. is the enemy of all Yemenis. We vow to continue our war against the enemy till our land is completely liberated.
Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen on March 2015 and maintained an all-out blockade on the war-torn country. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, including children, and led the country to the brink of famine.
People here hold the U.S. responsible for the deteriorating situation in their country, which according to the U.N. is suffering the world's worst humanitarian crisis. They say the U.S. policies have emboldened Saudi Arabia to increase its pressure on the impoverished nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Dockers from the Autonomous Port Workers Collective Union, or CALP, say ships carrying cargoes of tanks, helicopters and other weapons are continued to be sent to Saudi Arabia from Italian ports in breach of local laws and the country's constitution. In January this year, Rome introduced a ban on arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates due to their involvement in the war on Yemen, where tens of thousands of civilians have been killed so far. In June, however, some of the restrictions were eased after Abu Dhabi threatened to evict Italian aircraft and personnel from a key military base in retaliation for the arms embargo. Dockers say U.S.-built tanks bound for Riyadh have recently transited through the port of Genoa.
The latest shipment of weapons arrived at the Genoa port about 2 weeks ago. There were 12 third-generation M1 Abrams tanks, as many transport and combat helicopters, and several containers full of missiles, warheads destined for Saudi Arabia. Every 20-25 days, a new shipment of weapons docks at the Genoa port.
According to the CALP Dockers Union, the ban on arms sales produced in Italy on Riyadh and Abu Dhabi is circumvented by disassembling the weapons and sending the pieces separately. Dockers Unions and the Weapon Watch, which is an independent observatory on arms transfers through Italian ports, say each time new shipments of weapons reaches Genoa, they inform the port authorities, but no action is taken. CALP Dockers have said a new anti-militaristic internationalist movement is growing, with port workers from several cities across the world ready to join forces. Unions are working on organizing an international strike against arms exports towards countries involved in the war in mid-December.
A new shipment of weapons is scheduled for loading on a Saudi cargo at the port of Genoa this weekend. Dockers will be staging a protest with hundreds of people marching to the port to support them. Max Civili, Rome.
It's a day as usual for millions of residents across the bustling Indian capital, New Delhi, as winter looms, debates and awareness about pollution starts making news. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. With the arrival of the festival of Diwali and the farmers clearing fields for the next crop, it's the capital which has to pay heavy price. Over the last 2 weeks, New Delhi has been choking with a lethal layer of thick smog hovering over the residents, who are now gasping for fresh air. For this labor working in the outskirts of Delhi, it's a day as usual. Since last week, the hospitals are witnessing rising numbers of admissions, as many are struggling with breathing issues. Health officials have advised people to stay indoors and avoid outdoor physical activities. New Delhi has taken some measures, such as work from home for government employees and ban on trucks entering the city till November 26. But many say there is a need for a long-term solution.
I think the government must take this issue serious, as it's the matter of health of the citizens. If we can't take steps now, our future generation will pay a heavy cost.
Considering the alarming situation, schools have also been shut till further notice. The country's top court directed the administration to take this issue on utmost priority and find a long-term solution. The air quality in New Delhi deteriorated after Diwali on November 4, shrouding the entire capital with toxic smog. Stubble burning by farmers in the neighboring state of Haryana and Uttar Pradesh, which surrounds the capital, is also blamed for the crisis. The story is the same every year.
This morning, the air quality has improved due to change in wind speed. The administration has also taken a string of measures to tackle the crisis. Experts, however, say more strategies are needed to solve the pollution crisis in the Indian capital. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Join us in this journey.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.